This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Which impose upon us the obligation to demonstrate to the non-Jewish world that we are Chachomim and Nevoidim, that we are wise people. And the reason we learned in the Sifurnu was because it is clear to everybody that we are the chosen people by virtue of the fact that it is possible for us to arouse a reaction from the Ribbono Shel Olam in a way that no other nation can do. Our tefillah is heard immediately. And the world knowing that we are the chosen people, it would be a chilul Hashem if they looked at us as unintelligent. If they see us as intelligent people, and we are the chosen people of the Ribbono Shel Olam, then it's a kiddush Hashem. And so we're told, "Ushmartim v'asisim," you must keep the Torah, "ki hichoch maschem uvinaschem le'enei ha'amim," because this is your wisdom and your understanding in the eyes of the nations. It's important to do so. So last night we explained on the basis of that Sipurnu why it's important to convey that impression of wisdom, why it is important not only that we are wise but that we are seen to be wise also. This evening I want to look at the question of how does one do that? What exactly is the Pasuk requiring of us? The way the Pasuk reads now is Ushmartim v'asisim, you must keep the Torah. Ki hichoch maschem uvinaschem le'enei ha'amim, because through that they will judge our wisdom. And why is it important that they judge us wise? Ki mi goy godel asher lo yelukim krovim elov, because there is no other nation who has God so near to them, and therefore we must be seen to be intelligent. How do we do that? Says Rashi, Ushmartim, when the Torah says and you shall keep it, that means Zu Mishnah. That's the Mishnah. Va'asisen, and you shall do them, Kemashmo, that can be taken literally. So Ushmartim cannot be taken literally, Va'asisen can be taken literally. Ushmartim means you must learn Mishnayos, and Va'asisen means you must do the mitzvahs. Ki hichoch maschem uvinaschem, because this is your wisdom and your understanding in the eyes of the nations, says Rashi. Bezois teichashvu chachomim unuvoinim le'enei ha'amim. In this, with this, through this, you shall be considered chachomim unuvoinim, wise people and understanding people in the eyes of the nations. What does bezois mean? If it weren't for the few words of Rashi that came before, I would say bezois means through the Torah, by keeping the Torah, you will be considered wise in the eyes of the nation. But that's not what Rashi says. Bezois in this, what? What's the this? Ushmartim v'asisim. What's the ushmartim v'asisim? Mishnah and keeping the mitzvahs. What does that mean? If it just means that you must keep the Torah, you must know the Torah and keep the Torah, should you say that the Torah is Chochmaschem uvinaschem? From Rashi it implies that the chiddush of this posuk is the order of things. Ushmartim v'asisim. You shall learn and you shall do. And if that's the case, it's very difficult, because that's exactly the opposite from what Yisrael undertook to do at Sinai, and for which they were praised so exaltedly. They said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we'll do and then we'll learn. And the first thing is we undertake to do, then we'll learn. And the angel said, Ribbono Shel Olam says, "Mi gilo lebonai razeh." Who told them the secret of first you learn, first you do, and then you learn? Where did they get it from? How did they rise to such a level of understanding? Here Moshe Rabbeinu tells them the opposite. Ushmartim v'asisim. You learn and then you do, because that's the way that the chachamim will. That's the way the goyim will see your wisdom. So on one hand, Rashi has explained a great deal to us. It's not telling us you must keep the Torah because the goyim will respect you for that. That's not the reason we keep the Torah. What Rashi is telling us is that the Torah says, learn before you keep, know what you're keeping, and keep it meticulously according to the Mishnah. Then you will be considered Chacham. And he goes on to say, as kashiloi tishbichu oisam v'tasu malamitosam, then if you don't forget the mitzvahs and you do them correctly, teichashvu chachomim unavonim, you will be considered wise people. V'im ta'avtu oisam mitoch shikho, and if through forgetfulness you will distort the mitzvahs, teichashvu shoitim, you will be considered foolish people. And that, Rashi, we also need to understand. What does it mean if you distort them because of forgetfulness? And what happens if you distort them not because of forgetfulness, because you never knew them to start with? Or you didn't understand them properly? What's the forgetfulness got to do with it? There's a wonderful concept which is hidden behind this Rashi. In one of the meetings that I had with Reb Meir Soloveitchik, I asked him why it is and what can we do to avoid this, to change it. But it's becoming embarrassing already that you go to a non-Jewish school and you see children well behaved. They stand up when an adult walks into the class. They address an adult as sir. There's silence in the class. They say excuse me if they bump into you. They say good morning to you when they meet you. They say goodbye to you when you walk out. It's a pleasure. You walk into a Jewish school, absolute nothing. No derech eretz, no middos, absolutely nothing. We talked about it. The next time we came in, when I'd prepared a whole different subject altogether, because I thought we'd exhausted that subject. As I sat down, he said, you were admiring the nimusim, the manners of the goyim. And then he just tore into me. He says, you thought that was worth something. Now I'll tell you. And he went in and we discussed something very interesting, which we'll talk about some other time. But the concept is still a very worrying one. That the goyim have got very far with their nimusim. Nimusim means their ethical conduct. Their own ethical conduct, which they didn't then get from Torah, they've worked it out themselves. The levels which were reached by some of the early non-Jewish philosophers in the understanding of ethics and conduct is amazing. Aristotle was quoted freely by Rishonim and the early Achronim in Divrei Torah and works of Torah. The Rambam calls him the Chochem, the Akedah calls him the Chochem. They quote lines and lines, paragraphs and paragraphs of his work. Where did he get it from? Who taught him the Torah? Nobody. This is something which he worked out. And how far did he get? Very far. In some ways even, they seem to have got further than us. And that's where it becomes even more disturbing. Because we need to understand it. The Catholics work out that to be really holy and dedicated to the Ribono Shel Olam, you can't be married as well. You can't have two bosses. If you want the Ribono Shel Olam as a boss, then he's your boss. If you want to get married, then you can't have shittuf. You can't have two bosses. Or in their case, three. Two they'll have, but not three. In a sense, they're right. It makes sense. It's logical. And it's understandable. And we even see hints of it in the Torah. There was a time where Moshe Rabbeinu had to cease behaving as a normal married man. Got to that level, one sees there is something in it. So what have they got further than us? Not to suggest that every Catholic priest is necessarily somebody who subscribes to this. But some of them surely do. And if they do, and at least if they set that as a standard, isn't there something in it? Why was Rabbeinu Gershom Mesaken that we shouldn't marry more than one wife? Because the goyim started it. And he felt that there is such a principle that if the goyim introduce something which appears ethical and correct, even if the Torah doesn't require it, we have to do it. And since it became accepted among the non-Jews that it's ethical to marry only one wife, we adopted it into Yiddishkeit as well, but that's where it came from. Is it possible that with their minds they are working out nimusim, they are working out ethical conduct, principles of ethical conduct, which go beyond, in a sense, and certainly to the same levels as the conduct that we're able to achieve through Torah. There's a Gemara on Daf Peches in Shabbos. How tziduki? It was a certain apikoros. The chazir lerove the koma'ayin b'shmaisa. He saw Rove learning. He was very lucky. What I would give to see Rove learning. He meant just to see, not even to talk to him, just to peer through the window and to watch him. The tziduki saw him learning. What did he see? V'yasvo atzboso deyode tutikara. And he was sitting with his finger under his leg. He was sitting with his hand under his leg. And he was squashing his finger so badly that his finger was being hurt so badly, it was being squashed that it started bleeding. The blood was pouring out of his finger. That's what he saw. Imagine, there's Rover learning and blood pouring out of his finger. And he doesn't notice. Carries on learning. Omale. So this apikoros did what I would never have done. He disturbed Rover. He was interested in this vision. Omo Peziza, this impulsive nation. The Kadmisu Pumaichu Ludnaichu, who put your mouths before your ears. Akati b'fach zutaychu kamaisu. I see that you're still as impulsive as you ever were, you funny people. Bereisha ibayeluchu lemishmo imetzisu kablisu v'iloi loy kablisu. First you should have listened to the Torah before, when God gave you the Torah, first you should have listened to it and decided whether you can accept it or you can't accept it. So what are you going to do? Nice of an Ishmael before you even know what's inside it. You're impulsive people. So he said, Anan the Saginan Bishlemuso, we who go after Shlemus, after perfection and Tmimus and straightness, Ktiv Banat says about us, Tumas Yeshorim Tanche, the straightness of straight people will lead them. Hanach Inshi the Sagan Baaliluso, these people that go in crooked ways, Ksiv Buhu Veselef Boigdim Yeshode, and the crookedness of crooked people will cause them to fall. Very strange Gemara altogether. What's the bleeding finger got to do with it? Why does that show impulsiveness? What's the question? What's the answer? Where does he see impulsiveness? In the action of Rava. Rava sitting and learning, poring over a Gemara, and his finger's bleeding and he doesn't know that his finger's bleeding. So what's so impulsive about that? What he sees is a man doing something insane. He sees a man so enwrapped in his ideals that he forgets about reality. That's how the tzaddik sees it. What's reality, man? The reality is your finger needs a bandage. That's what it is. Take it out of your leg and fix it up and carry on learning. That's reality. You want to read in the holy book, you want a bit of fun, you want to learn a bit. You don't have to hurt yourself in the process. There's no need for it. The reality is you're suffering, so fix the suffering and carry on learning. He sees a meshugana. He sees a person who walks around with a wound which is self-inflicted for no reason whatever, just pure carelessness, and doesn't fix it. He's so engrossed in what he's doing that the real things he's not noticing. That's what disturbs the tzaduki. You're so impulsive, you become so involved in your ideals and you're so dedicated to them that you're not realistic. Nice edition, on the spur of the moment, you get so excited and elated. We'll do it, we'll keep it, everything. How do you know you'll keep it? What's inside it? First listen to it, hear what's inside it, and then you decide whether you'll accept it or you won't. That too, says the tzaduki, this apikoros, is a sign of that same kind of impulsiveness and ignoring reality for the sake of an ideal. The reality is the Torah is terribly demanding and you didn't know what would be asked of you. That's the reality. A realistic person weighs it up. He takes out a long piece of paper and he draws a column down the middle. And he writes on the top of one column pros, and on the other column he writes cons, and he starts listing the pros of accepting the Torah and the cons of accepting the Torah. And then he adds them up, and then he sleeps over it, and the next morning he makes a decision. That's how a realistic person does it, not you people. You're a nice seven Ishmael before you know what you're doing. So Rava answers him. And he says, Anan tisaginan b'shleimusu. We are after shleimus. And you're after crookedness. There's a difference. What does that mean? There have been holy non-Jews. What does it mean? And there probably are holy non-Jews. Means a person who desires more than anything to come close to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what a holy person is. There have been emistic non-Jews. Non-Jews who desire more than anything to discover the truth. There have been moral non-Jews. Non-Jews who desire more than anything and regard and value more than anything ethics and morality. And they'll be most nefesh for these things. A holy non-Jew will be most nefesh for coming close to the Ribbono Shel Olam. A moral non-Jew will be most nefesh for morality. And an emistic non-Jew will be most nefesh for emistic. And in every generation there are such non-Jews who put themselves in danger and sometimes die doing things which are idealistic and for which they are prepared to dedicate their lives. Where do they differ from us? These people, where do they differ from us? Reb Simcha Zissel has a principle which is very difficult to understand. And he says that the mere fact that one is doing that because one wants to, the mere fact that one is pursuing holiness because one wants to be holy, one is pursuing truth because one wants to be close to the truth, one is pursuing ethics because one wants to be ethical, that in itself is already what he calls shituf rotzoin. There's a partner to your judgment, and that's your own will. You're doing it, why? Not just because it's true, not just because it's ethical, and not just because it's holy. There are two things here. I'm doing it because it's holy and I want to be holy. I'm doing it because it's ethical and I want to be ethical. I'm doing it because it's truthful and I want to be truthful. There you're already on dangerous ground. Why? Because the next thing you've got to ask yourself is, good, so how do I do it? So you start making svaras, you start working things out. And you say, for example, that it works out that there's no question that material things distract one from holy things. There is no question that money corrupts. You analyze it, you study it, and you come to the conclusion that money and material things corrupt. So you give away all your money, and you give away all your material things, and you go and you live in a cave. That's a logical conclusion. It's a logical thing to do in the pursuit of holiness. To be completely dedicated to the Ribbono Shel Olam with the responsibility of a wife and family, can't. So it's logical to say, if I want to reach those levels of Kedusha, I've got to give up married life. A person who wants to be extremely ethical, and he stands in front of his students as a teacher, and his students are misbehaving, and the only way he can get them to behave is to shout at them, to impose his discipline on them. Now he weighs up, is that moral? Is that ethical? For me to impose? Who am I? Who says I'm any better than them? Who am I to tell them what to do? Am I going to be cruel to them? Am I going to hurt them? Am I going to embarrass them and insult them? Surely these are negative things. If I'm going to be holy, how can I embarrass people? If I'm going to be holy, how can I discipline people? How can I shout at people? So he turns the other cheek and he smiles. It's logical, it's correct. He's worked out that cruelty is immoral, therefore I will not be cruel. And so on and so on and so on. There is no end to the extent to which the mind, if it's dedicated to that, can work out levels of holiness which are not in accordance with the Torah, and yet one can't fault them when one looks at them. Reb Chaim Volozhiner says in the Orchus Chaim, in the name of the Gro, Aveiro Lishmo lo yhutar mizman matan toiro klu. An aveiro lishmo means one does something wrong, but one does it l'shem shemayim. And we're talking here about whether it's 100% l'shem shemayim. A person has to do something wrong, but he is doing it not for his own desires. He's doing it only because the end justifies the means, and the end is pure and holy and absolutely okay. Can the end justify the means? Ever, the Groh was asked. Says the Vilna Gaon, not after Matan Torah. Up till the giving of the Torah, yes. Each person could weigh up in his own mind, as great and as pure and as spiritual as those minds were, what is right and what is wrong, and he could do it. But not after Matan Torah. Because if it was allowed after Matan Torah, says the Groh, you wouldn't need a Shulchan Aruch that tells you what to do and what not to do. Let every person do what he wants, as long as it's L'shem Shemayim. But there has to be one seif in the Shulchan Aruch. There can be one paragraph of the Shulchan Aruch. Kol ma'atecha yiyu L'shem Shemayim. Finished. Whatever you do should be L'shem Shemayim. And that would be the whole Shulchan Aruch. By the fact that we have a Shulchan Aruch that governs every step of our life from the moment we wake up until the time we go to sleep and after, we see that it's not like that. Aval be'emes, the truth is, achar matan Torah, after the giving of the Torah, ein lozuz mikol Torah u'mitzvos v'divrei Chazal. One is not permitted to move away from the Torah, mitzvos, and psakim of Chazal. V'sheloi lehishoin al daat hayetzer. And one is not permitted to rest on the calculations of the Yetzer. And gam bizman hazeh arashus nesuno and even today non-Jews are permitted to work this way. A non-Jew can design his own form of avodah. He wants to serve God, he can serve God the way he wants to, as long as what he does is l'shem shemayim, and as long as he keeps the sheva mitzvahs b'nei noach, that's okay. If he decides that standing on his head every morning is going to become an avodah, l'shem l'ribayna shalom, that's how he serves the ribayna shalom. So he can stand on his head every morning. That's a new mitzvah he's made for himself. Aval lanu b'nei Yisrael, but to us Jewish people, nitno ha-toiro, nosno ha-toiro, geder u'gvul. The Torah imposes fences and borders. V'chol ha-maiseh nichlal b'tzivui v'azhora, and every action is either a mitzvah or a prohibition. Whatever we do has to fit into either to an area of something positive or something negative. V'geder ha-chassidus, and if you want to be extra special for him, then you don't make new mitzvahs. But ledakdek bohen ad kotzei ho'achare, then you medakdek, you're more careful to the last detail of the halachas. V'lifresh me'echod mishivim mishara yisur, and to move away even from 1/70th of a question of anything which might be wrong. And to be careful about every meticulous detail of the halachas, the rabbonim, the laws of the rabbis. And so he goes on. Here we have the difference between the Jewish people after Matan Torah on the one hand, and on the other hand, the Jewish people before Matan Torah, and Goyim even today. That we have a Shulchan Aruch which has to be followed meticulously. Whereas before Matan Torah, each person made his own Shulchan Aruch using his Ruach HaKodesh and his Nevuah to understand what God wants and what God doesn't want. The consequence of that is that we can do things which nobody would ever have thought of. And yet we do them. We find that cruelty is a middah which we have to exercise. That's the halacha. There are times when a father has to be a little bit cruel to a child. Chazal says, Al yotil emo yaseiru abonov. A person must not impose too much fear on his children and bnei beis and his family. Too much fear he mustn't impose, but some fear he must impose. It doesn't help just loving them and hugging them and kissing. That alone is not enough. That's avo. But there has to be yiro as well. Not too much, but there has to be there. When one's teaching, there has to be a certain one has to impose a discipline on one's talmidim. That requires the use of midas, which if one would look at on their own, they're negative. It requires a degree of gaiva. requires a degree of arrogance. Who am I to tell you what to do? That means that I think I'm qualified to do so, otherwise I wouldn't do so. That's a terrible thing. It's arrogance. And if it isn't done, I've got to make a fuss about it. That's even more arrogance. I told you to do it and you didn't do it. So who am I to make a fuss? I told you and you decided not to do it. Surely you're an intelligent human being. But that's not good enough. And if it still isn't done, then I'm going to say, you know, my dear fellow, this isn't the place for you. If I've asked you to do something once and I've reminded you a second time, that means you're not makabel from me. I told you, that means I've thought about it, and you're not doing it, that means you're not accepting my authority. You can't sit here. That's even worse. That's arrogance, and it's cruelty, and it hurts people. All negative things. And yet it has to be. There's a time that one has to be marchik, besmoil, or makarib biyamin. But at the same time, one has to draw a person close with one's right hand and push him off with one's left hand. Two contradictory things. How does one do both of them? The karev biyamin, I understand, but that at the same time, you've also got to push him aside. These are halachas. That's how it has to be. I might think, as they think, that if you really want to get holy, you mustn't be married. Says the Torah, the opposite. If you really want to be holy, you must be married and get married young. Exactly the opposite. Who would have known such a thing? Who would have worked such a thing out? The principle of Naaseh V'Nishma is that we're going to practice the Torah not through what we've worked out. Naaseh V'Nishma, we'll work it out once we're practicing it already. Once we're doing it, we'll strive to understand why it's right and why it's correct, and why there's nothing better to do than that, and why it's perfect. But we're not first going to work out what is perfect and then do it. Says the Gro, once the Torah is given, we are completely bound to every detail of the Shulchan Aruch, and we can't move left or right. Let's now try and understand the Gemara in Shabbos. The Goy looks at him, the Apikodos looks at Rava, and he says, you're in a dream world, Rava, and you've always been you people. Unrealistic. Your hand is bleeding and you haven't even noticed it. What's wrong with you? Answers Rove, we're after shleimus. We're not after holiness. We're not after truth. We're not after ethics and morality. We're after shleimus, perfection. And perfection is something which comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And once that's the case, Apikodos says to him, you must understand that reality is not my bleeding finger. What I was learning was reality. That's where everything starts from. We start with the Torah and then we come down to earth. We have our 2 feet firmly implanted in the Torah, not on earth. And that we impose onto the earth. The Torah is not a reflection of the earth. Any legal system is a reflection of a society. You look at the legal system and you can see where the society is holding. Torah is not a reflection of a society. Torah doesn't change according to the society. The society is meant to be a reflection of Torah. The world is meant to be a reflection of the Torah. Yistakel bo araisu v'arom. The Ribbono Shel Olam looked in the Torah and created the world to fit the Torah. He didn't create the Torah to fit the world. He didn't look at human beings and say, now if I just leave them alone, they're going to steal from each other. Right, lo signos. If I just leave them alone, they're going to murder each other. Lo silzach. Didn't do that. First, he said there is a universal principle of shleimus, that if there were such a thing as a human being, and there were such a thing as another human being, they should be prohibited from murdering one another. Lo sirtzach, long before there were any human beings or any world. If there are human beings who have possessions, imagine, hypothesis, imagine such a thing as a human being who has possessions, and imagine another human being who wants those possessions. Lo signos. The truth is, shleimus is, that they should not steal from one another. When that was all finished, the Ribbono Shel Olam said, now let's create such people. Let's take and make people who have things and who desire each other's things and who are jealous of one another and who get aggressive with one another. Let's make people to fit the Torah and let them give expression to the Torah in reality. But the reality is the Torah, the reality is not the people. You, Apikurus, look at my bleeding finger and you think, oh, you look at blood coming out of his finger, and then you see him, what's he doing? He's learning. And you think that the learning is just one of the things. The real thing is, here is a man who's sitting with a bleeding finger. Says Rav, that's not so. Here is a man who's sitting and learning Torah. Why is he learning Torah? His fingers dizzy, so what? If a person is drowning in the sea, and as he's about to drown and go under and he can't hold himself up anymore, he sees a piece of a plank of wood and he grabs onto it. And he's so pleased in the cold and in the suffering, but he's got this plank of wood and he holds onto it for all his worth. And while he's holding onto it, his little toe starts itching. Is he going to worry about it? He won't even notice it. His mind will be totally focused on the saving of his life. He's busy. What's the reality? His itchy foot? His itchy toe? No, that's not the reality. The reality is holding on to life. That's what's real. Everything else is gone. It just doesn't matter. That's all. That's the Torah. It's a plank of life for those who are holding on to it. That's life. That's it. That's the real thing. And what's everything else? Absolutely subsidiary. When one understands that, but understands it properly, then one begins to understand how the Gedolei Yisrael operate, what the Torah really expects of us. It's very strange when a person is healthy and feeling comfortable and he's negotiating a deal in his office or on the stock exchange floor. What's reality at that moment? The business. That's all that's real. If a person has got a bad cold, all that's real at that moment is his nose running. Everything else is ancillary to that. What's real is the major problem he faces is the running nose. If a person has a headache, a migraine, there's nothing in the world but that throbbing head behind his eyes there. There's nothing else. That's reality. Everything else pales into insignificance. We're funny. Our sense of reality changes to whatever we happen to be doing at that moment, to whatever creates the biggest challenge at that moment. That's what's real, and everything else is nothing. But that's not how it's meant to be. We need to have complete control over what is reality and what isn't. They talk about mind over matter, and they're coming close to the emes when they talk about mind over matter, but we're going a step further. We're talking about Torah over matter. Mind over matter, you still have to decide what must be in your mind over the matter. Torah over matter is that everything that one does, including the expressions of one's feelings and emotions, is all subject to the Torah and is all controlled by the Torah. We learned this morning in the Ladies' Shir very intense few lines of Tanakh. After David is married Bathsheba, a baby is born. And Nosson tells him that the baby is going to die. Nosson the Novi. The truth is that although everything the Novi says is true, and that means at that time death has been decreed for the baby, we know from Chizkiyahu and his sickness, where Yeshayahu told him he was about to die, that that can be reversed. Through Tefillah, Chizkiyahu got himself an extra 15 years of life, although he was told by a Novi, none less than Yeshaya, that he was about to die. So David doesn't take that as a matter which cannot be taken any further. And by Yavakesh David Eso Elokim Ba'ad Hanoah, David prays to the Ribbono Shel Olam for the sake of the baby. But how does he daven? Vayotzom David tzoim, and David fasted. Not like we fasted on Shivos of the Tammuz from the morning till the night. And not even like we fasted on Tisha B'Av from the night until the next night. He fasted day after night, night after day, a continuous long fast. Uvo velon v'shochovat, and he came home to sleep. He slept on the ground. Vayokumu zikne v'isoyolov. You can imagine what this was doing in the palace. Imagine a modern leader today cracks up because his baby is ill. And all of a sudden they come in, a foreign dignitary comes in and wants to speak to the president. Where is he? He's sleeping on the floor. Okay, I'll wait till he wakes up. Wakes up, he doesn't speak to him. Okay, I'll wait till supper time. Maybe I'll have supper with him. He doesn't eat. He doesn't have to eat. When last did you eat? Days he hasn't eaten. He looks drab, unshaven and unkempt and thin and gaunt. And the word goes around The president's no longer fit to govern. Well, he's gone off his mind. Well, the baby's sick and he has no control over himself. And the Ziknei Beisa were very worried by Akumu Ziknei Beisa Olov, and the elders of his home came up to him, Lahakimu Minoritz, to get him up from the land. You can't have a king that cracks up over an emotional issue. V'loi Ovo, and he didn't accept it. V'loi Voro Iton Lochem, and he would not accept food from them. Vayehi Bayom HaShivi, and it was the seventh day after these goings on, Bayomos Hayoled, and the child died. Vayiru Avdei David, Lahagid Loi Kimes Hayoled. And the servants of David got together, the doctors and the advisors and the ministers. Who'll go and tell the king that the child is dead? Not I, says the doctor. Not I, says the prime minister. Not I, says the household master. Nobody would go. I think I'm crazy. Did you see how he was reacting to the child when he was still alive? What's he going to do when he hears that he's dead? So they keep the news away from him. Because they said, when the child was alive, we talked to him and there was no communication, he didn't hear us. How are we going to tell him now that the child is dead? But also, who knows what terrible thing he will do? And he noticed that, David noticed that his servants were whispering. They say that when a person, Nebuch, is fatally ill, and the family decides not to tell them, not to tell the person, that's one of the first indications he's got. People whispering alone, everybody's talking in low tones. He picks it up very quickly that there's a change in tone. David ki meis hayoled, and David understood that the child had died. David and David said to the servants, has the child died? And they said, yes, he has died. What does David do? Vayokom David mehoretz, and David gets up from the ground. Vayirchatz, and he takes a bath. Vayosech, and he has a massage, and he puts oils in. Vayechalif simloisov, and he changes his clothes. Vayovi veis Hashem, he goes to the Beis HaMedrash, to the Mishkan. Vayishtochu, he bows down to the Ribono Shel Olam. Vayovo el Beisa, and he came to his house. Vayishal vayasimu lo lechem vayoichal. And he asked for food, and they gave him a meal, and he ate. Exactly the opposite of what they expected. Vayomru avodo veilov, and his servant said to him, Mohadovra ze asher osiso, what is this strange conduct of yours? Bavura yelet chai tzanto vatevk. Because of the living child, when the child was still alive, you fasted and you cried. Bechashe mesa yelet, and when the child is dead and it's really time to cry, you're up and you're eating. Says the Akedah, they're hinting that that's a sign that his original grief was insincere. It's not normal. We thought at that time that you were a little bit meshuga, but okay, so you've gone off your mind and you feel terribly, terribly sad about the whole business and you've taken it very seriously. But like that, you turn it, you hear the child dead and you're up, off the ground, eating a meal, having a bath. That shows that you couldn't have been very sincere about your grief. That's what they're challenging with. And here we have a beautiful example of a communication between David Melech Yisrael, a Godol Shebegdoilim, one of the greatest people we've ever had, and his Ziknei Beisa, his elders of his home, who must also have been rather great people to be serving David. But yet they looked at David like an ordinary man and judged him as they would an ordinary man, and he defied their predictions. Why? Because an ordinary man, when he grieves so seriously and so tragically, what is the cause of his grief? The cause of his grief is the sick child. Therefore, if the child gets more sick, he should grieve still more. And if the child gets still more sick, he should grieve still more. And if the child dies, he should grieve absolutely. But with David Melech Yisrael, it's not like that. Vayomer, and David answers, and he tells them the Yisoid. Because what we have here, what David is going to tell us here, is the Yisoid, the foundation of the Torah's view to emotional expression. When and how does one express deep emotions? Under what circumstances? Bo'oid hayeled chai tzamti voevke. While the child was still alive, I fasted and I cried, Ki amati miyodea yechanani Hashem v'chaya yolid. Because I said, who knows, if I'm misfired enough, maybe the Rebbeinu Shlom will hear me and the child will live. V'yato, and now? Mace, he's dead. Loma anitzom. What is there to fast for? Ha'uchel l'hashiv o'ed? Can I bring him back? Ani ho'ilech eilav v'hulo yoshuv eilav. I will go to him eventually. He's not going to come back to me. That's over. It's finished. Complete mastery over his emotions. Able to express the extreme of grief one moment and the next moment after hearing the death of the child, no less, to return to absolute normality. There's no din of avelus for a 7-year-old child. He doesn't have to sit shiva. There's nothing. So there's nothing to do. To be misparal while the child is alive, that he has to do. Once there's no point in the tefillah, there's nothing more to do, and he's got to go back to running the country. A complete reversal, min hakotze el hakotze, from one extreme to the other, of his emotional feelings. They look at it as, what is reality? Reality is a dying baby and a grieving father. That's their reality. An artist would come and would paint the picture, or a poet would come and would paint the picture with words. That's how they would do it. A fatally ill child, after altogether a very special and heavy, emotionally heavy and charged relationship between father and mother. Now comes this baby, the fruit of that relationship. The baby's dying. And the father cannot be comforted. A father who has responsibilities as a king is unable to pursue those responsibilities for the time being. And he is totally enwrapped in the most unbelievable grief and prayer. That's the reality. By David HaMelech, that's not the reality. What's the reality? A Ribbono Shel Olam? That's the reality. Who is punishing him, David HaMelech, with this sick child? That's the reality. The response to that, tefillah. It's a completely different thing. The picture which the artist paints is just the reflection. That's not the real thing. The real thing is God, the Ribbono Shel Olam, Torah, tefillah. That's the real thing. If we would know that, we would be able to predict his behavior. And what's the next scene? First scene's finished, the curtain's closed, the curtain's open again. And what's there? The way they see it, a dead child and a father who's out of his mind with grief. That's not the reality. What's the reality now according to David HaMelech? Nothing. The reality is finished now. The reality is running the country. The reality is learning Torah. The reality is getting back to his job. The reality is the living members of his family. That's it. Mourning, grief, there's no avelus. So the reality, the halacha, doesn't require grieving, and he's able to change within a moment and adapt his emotions to that which is real. What does it mean? Does it mean that David HaMelech didn't feel sad after the child died? If that were the case, his servants would be right. For a person to feel sad 1 minute and a second later nothing left of that sadness, that's abnormal. That can't be. That would seem to indicate that the original sadness was shallow. Sadness goes with time. One is sad and depressed, and slowly one gets over it. But a person who can just flip like that from one emotion to the other, those aren't genuine emotions, those aren't deep emotions. And that's what worries the Avodim, that's what worries the Zikne Beso. What's going on with you, David? We can't understand you. Are you that superficial that you can flick from one emotion to the other? What's the answer? Of course he was sad. But is it my business to impose my sadness on you? Is it my business to allow the country to suffer because I've suffered a personal loss? So then why were you so sad a few minutes ago? Because then there was purpose. That's what the Torah needed then. Because that sadness motivated a tefillah out of me which was so powerful that it could maybe reverse the decree. That's why I had to express it. But now there's no purpose in the expression of the emotion. And therefore I withdraw it. Not I don't feel it. But it's my own personal emotion. It has nothing to be expressed for. We see the degree of mastery. go and work out when you're allowed to show emotion and when you're not allowed to show emotion, and be able to switch it one moment, not switch the emotion, just the expression of the emotion, to turn it on when it needs to be on and to turn it off when it needs to be off, to understand that I'm permitted to express emotion only when there is a purpose in that expression. It is not my business to express my misery to other people. It is not my business to express my elation to other people unless there is purpose. If there's purpose, that becomes the reality. That's the halacha, not my sadness. That's not the reality. The reality is the purpose of my sadness, not the cause of my sadness. I'm sad because of something that's happened. But the reason I'm expressing that sadness is because what can be achieved through the expression of that sadness. I'm sad because the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. But the reason I express that sadness and don't just keep it to myself is because that can change people. That can rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. When people understand what has been lost, it's important for people to know. After a family loss, one goes into avelus. Why? It is important both for the departed person and for the survivors that there is avelus, that there is sadness. It's important that the family gets to appreciate, and even friends, that there is such a thing as death, that it's going to hit us all one day. These things are important. We mustn't just gloss over them. It needs to be communicated. It needs to be communicated to the Ribbono Shel Olam that we're missing the person who's gone. It's important for the person. There's purpose in the avelus, but after 30 days there's no longer purpose. It's finished. That's the end of it. Does that mean that after 30 days I don't feel sad anymore? Maybe you do. Maybe you feel sad for 10 years, but you have no right to impose that sadness on other people because it has no role to play in reality. The reality is not Nebuch, a person who's lost a relative. The reality is, what does the halacha say about this? The reality is avelus and the effect of avelus on the immediate society. That's what the reality is. Once we understand that, then it's possible to understand what the Torah requires of an individual. To be a person who's incapable of getting angry, just to kill the middle of anger within oneself. Nothing can make me angry. Number one, the Telzerov says that that's not possible. It's possible to subdue it. And one day it will burst out when you least expect it, and when it will be at its most destructive. Number two, he says, that even if you could do that, that would be part of loytirtzach. It would be part of suicide. You're murdering an aspect of yourself. You wouldn't be allowed to do it. But number three, if you could do it, there would be no kunz in not getting angry. Do we praise a block of wood that doesn't get angry? Ah, what about me this? You can stand on it, you can beat it, you can hit it. It never reacts. What about me this block of wood? Just look at it. Is that praiseworthy? That's not what the Torah wants. Not to have any Yetzirah at all, if it were possible. We learned last night that is possible only for sick people and dead people. But assuming it were possible that one could completely kill one's Yetzirah, would that be anything to be praised about? Nothing. A person who's not capable of getting jealous, absolutely has just killed all possibility within himself of ever being jealous of anybody. He says, I'm not jealous of anybody, so what? My cat also isn't jealous of anybody. Not capable of it. That's not a middle, that's not greatness. Greatness is the ability to get angry and not to get angry. Greatness is the ability to wring somebody's neck and not to wring their neck. Greatness is the ability to react and not to react. And greatness is the ability to incorporate even those negative things when they need to be incorporated in order to serve the Divine Shalom. To be cruel when one has to be cruel. To play angry at least, if not to get angry where one has to. A person who's not capable of anger can't even play anger. He becomes completely ineffectual. He's not going to fool anybody. Everybody knows you can't make him angry. Only a person who can get angry can act angry. And if one's incapable of acting angry, one's incapable of being effectual. If the goyim knew this, it would be even more dangerous. Because then they would have to find how to utilize these contradictory koches and remain moral and ethical. How are they going to do it? When must you use anger? When mustn't you? When must you use cruelty and when mustn't you? Even dishonesty. There are times when we're allowed to change the facts a little bit, when we have to change the facts a little bit. If you allow that without governing it by halacha, where's the end? Who's going to decide at what point is the boundary line? It's not capable, the human mind is not capable of doing that on its own. For that we need the Kabbalah Satoya. For that we need to accept the authority of the Torah. And that is nicer than Ishma. Whatever the Torah says, that's what we're going to do, that's where we're going to go. We're not going to work out because we can't. Now we can understand the Pasuk. Ushmartem zu Mishnah. Rashi doesn't say Ushmartem zu Torah, Ushmartem zu Gemara. So Shmartem zu Mishnah. What's important about the Mishnah? The Mishnah is the Masoiris, it's the Torah Shebaal Peh that was handed down generation to generation. It's the very basis of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's tradition. Va'asisem kemashmori. You shall do the Torah literally. So what's the order here? The order here is learn what you're doing first and then do it. There's a big chiddush in this Rashi. Naseh v'nishmo was only before the Torah was given. Before the Torah was given, we accept the Torah with the principle of naseh v'nishmo. We're going to accept this unconditionally. Naseh, we will do whatever's in the Torah. Now nishmo, now let's learn. And after learning what? Naseh again. Once you've got the Torah, you can't say naseh v'nishmo anymore. Now you've got to know what to do. Now it becomes Zu Mishnah, Shmartem Zu Mishnah. You've got to start learning meticulously what you need to do before you do it. Can't just start doing. Ve'asisem and then do it. Bezois, in this way, Teichashvu Chachomin Unvoinim Le'inei Ho'amim. Then the Goyim will see your wisdom and understanding. To see that you're able to get married and be holy. They'll understand that's great. They'll understand that's clever. They'll understand that they can't do that because they don't have the halacha that tells them where to draw the lines. To see a human being who's capable of being angry at one moment and capable of turning that anger off, not when he feels like it, but when it is no longer necessary, complete mastery of his own emotions. Aren't they going to realize that that's greater than somebody who always turns the other cheek and can never get angry? Aren't they going to realize that? To see a David HaMelech, who one moment is in the depths of grief and the next moment is back to normal. Not because he doesn't feel sad, but because there is no longer any purpose in those emotions. He has complete mastery over his emotions. He expresses them as and when there's purpose in them. Isn't that greater than somebody who can never express emotions or somebody who always expresses emotions? Always cries when he's sad, always laughs when he's happy. Can't one see that it's far greater to be able to laugh? Not whenever I'm happy. It's none of your business when I'm happy. Why must you know when I'm happy? Maybe at that moment you're sad and it's insensitive of me to laugh. It's not necessary for me to express my emotions whenever I feel like it. It's necessary for me to express my emotions whenever you need it. You, not me. And in fact, that's a principle in expression altogether. When I was in yeshiva, and we used to travel a bit because it was quite easy to get all sorts of student tickets across the continent. But you always used to have to change planes in weird places and stay over a couple of days, and it was all very nice and exciting. One of the places was Paris. And I remember going to Montmartre and looking at a particular young student artist painting something, and another one walked past me and saw me looking at it. And he put his arm around me and says, come, I've got something to show you. So I thought, okay, I doesn't get this opportunity in yeshiva, so let's expand a little bit. So he takes me up to an attic on top of one of these little old houses, and there he shows me the weirdest of weird paintings, one after the other. Weird, absolutely weird. So I said to him, what does this mean? I said, what does this mean? He says, why does it have to have meaning? What do you mean, what does it mean? I said, so why did you paint it? He said, I felt, that's me, I expressed myself. I said, interesting. This one, we went through the same thing. I said, I picked a particularly weird one. Ah, he says, this is very interesting. He says, I was absolutely high, I'd blown my mind, and this is, at that moment I did this, that's what I did. I said, well, why did you do it? He said, I needed to express myself. I said, would you ever like to see these hanging in a gallery? He says, yes. I said, do you think they're worthy of hanging in a gallery? He said, yes. I said, I must agree with you. Having seen what I've seen in some of the galleries in Paris, that visit, I think you're right. It qualifies. I said, do you think they should pay you for your picture? Or are they doing you an honour by hanging it? He says, no, they're doing me an honour, but of course they would have to pay. I said, imagine that the Museum of Modern Art wanted one of your paintings. What kind of figure would you think of negotiating with them? Yes, I don't remember the figure. It was something like $10,000. Don't you realize what you're saying? You had a need to express yourself, and you want me to pay you $10,000 for doing it? What it? You've told me something which you yourself admitted has no meaning to me. It's just how you felt. What chutzpah is it of you to impose your feelings on me and still make me pay for it? What chutzpah is it? Art is not self-expression. Who's got the right to express themselves at other people's expense? You want to express yourself? Lock yourself up in a room and express yourself. But to impose it on other people? And if your expression is negative, and if your expression is not true, must you impose your distorted vision of the world on innocent, naive people who can be affected by that just because you need to express yourself? Who are you? And because you're happy, you need to pass that happiness on to everybody else? Maybe I don't feel like being happy. Maybe it's Tisha B'Av for me. You come in, l'chaim, l'chaim, oh, come, let's dance and sing. Are you completely insensitive to my needs? And when I'm sad, it's Tisha B'Av? Is it for me to go to some guy who's having a nice time and tell him, you know, ooh, tell him a whole story about Tisha B'Av, make him sad? Is that my business? We see in this little parsha of Chumash and in all these inyonim that we've discussed tonight, and what we need to do is to be able to impose the reality on this little world in which we live. Not react in reality to the little world in which we live. One expresses oneself when there's a need. Not in oneself, but in those to whom one is expressing oneself. One is not permitted to express oneself by word, by deed, by gesture, by artistic production. There is no need for that expression in other people. I can't speak because I feel like speaking. Not allowed to. And at all times the expression has to be governed by the purpose. I can't always control the way I feel. If a tragedy happens, I can't help feeling sad. If a Torah would tell me, thou shalt not feel sad, I would have to be over. The Torah doesn't say such a thing. And that's why most of the Rishonim hold even on the Ahav to the Re'acha Kamoicha, says the Ramban, that doesn't mean you must love your neighbor as yourself. The Torah won't tell you to love somebody. I can't tell you to love somebody. If you don't like him, how can I love? All it can tell you is, act towards him as if you love him. That's what it means. But not love him, thou shalt love. There's no such thing as thou shalt love. Thou shalt be sad, thou shalt be happy. There was some old Sidurim that used to be printed in German, and I remember in certain places, in the Kinos, in Tisha B'Av, and there were places, various other places in the davening, I think it was, it used to say, here you must cry. And I said, so you do it and you cry. You can't tell a person, you shall cry, you shall be sad, you can't. What you can tell a person is, if you are sad, you shall not express that sadness at this point. If you are sad, now is the time to express that sadness with all you've got, because there's purpose in it. If you're happy, you cannot express it in this circumstance, but you shall express it in that circumstance. A complete mastery over the expressions of one's emotions. And we're living in a world where the opposite is being encouraged. The opposite is being encouraged by Western society, the Americans in the main. They like, no offense to the Americans. The Americans who like calling a spade, and they like crying when they're sad and laughing when they're happy and all laughing together and all being sad together and being honest and open. The English are the opposite. They, even when there's a need to express their emotions, don't. Torah is right in the middle. The emotion has to be there. A person who doesn't feel the emotion is dead. The expression of the emotion, that depends on the needs of the environment, the needs of the environment in which one finds oneself, not on one's own needs. A person himself can't express his emotions just because he needs to do so. When a guy sees that, isn't that impressive? When a person sees that by us, if we can either be like the Englishman or we can be like the Americans, there is nothing in the middle. We're either going to be like the Latin countries, who gesticulate and shout and scream and laugh and shine and cry, and whatever they feel comes out, and more than they feel comes out as well. Or we're going to be like the Germans, like the Teutonic people, like the English, never expressing emotion. Absolutely not. But to find a nation who is able to express extreme emotion of one kind one minute and the opposite the other minute, not because they're inconsistent in their feelings, but because they can master their expression. Provided you're following the Torah meticulously, doing it where the Torah tells you. Otherwise you're finished. If you're going to work it out yourself, you've got no basis. When are you going to, on what basis are you going to decide if there is purpose in being sad or not, expressing the sadness? On what basis are you going to decide if this is time to be cruel or it's time to be kind? On what basis are we going to make those decisions? Just on our own valuations? That has to be by Allah. When reality is that now it requires sadness, we give it the sadness. When the reality determines that now must be the happiness, we give it the happiness. But for that there must be Mishnah first. There's got to be a Mesoras. One's got to know how to do these things, when to do them. There has to be a tradition which is handed down with meticulous details that govern the expression of these things. V'asisem, and then you do it. B'zois teichashvu chachomim unavoinim la'inei ha'amim. But if you forget one detail, the whole thing can start looking weird. Because you forget one detail, if the goyim forget a detail, it's not serious. Because they're on safe ground. The English and the Germans never show their emotions. So what can they forget? You're not going to see the difference. The Americans always show their emotions, even when they don't feel them. So what can they forget? What are you going to notice? If it's a happy occasion, they're all happy. If it's a sad occasion, they're all sad. So what's going to go missing if somebody forgets a particular detail in how to handle complex situations? Nothing's going to happen. There's nothing to forget. There's nothing to know. You work it out yourself. And the lines are very clearly demarcated. When it comes to Torah, and the lines are not demarcated at all, except through halacha, there one can't afford to miss one detail. It has to be accurate. Otherwise we're going to make a mess of it. We are not a people who never show sadness. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. Now what's going to happen if we're going to show sadness in the place where pi halacha we should be happy? Or the other way around? We talked last night of the importance of an individual to be able to show his bracha, to be able to show that he has what he has. To be able to, there are times when one has to be able to show the happiness of one's blessing. There are times when one has to hide it a little bit. Go and do it the wrong way around, it can be a terrible mess. You've got people who always dress formally. Always formally. Top hat, tails, bow tie. You've got people who always dress informally. Open neck shirt, it's not open neck shirt anymore. It used to be open neck shirt. Then it became open chest shirt, and now it's open tummy shirt. That's how he always dresses, and short pants and sandals, that's how he always goes. So you don't expect anything more from him. That's how he always is. So if he comes into a formal occasion and that's how he dresses, that's how he always dresses. If the fellow is always dressed in his top hat, comes to the beach in Durban in his top hat, that's how he always goes. No. But somebody who decides, and we know that he's careful how he dresses. If he goes to a very fashionable dinner, he'll wear his top hat and tails. If he's going to the beach, he'll wear his shorts and sandals. And such a person, a normal human being, walks in to a very, very fancy reception given by the state president in his sandals and short pants. Shaita, fool and idiot, they'll call him. They won't call him eccentric. The one who always walks like that is eccentric. But he's an idiot, he's foolish, he's misjudged. What's gone wrong? He hasn't been sensitive to the halach. Once you're playing with these narrow little relationships and these weighings up and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, once we're making such complicated emotional recipes, you can't go by intuition. Here you have to go by knowledge. Ushmartem zu Mishnah. Then if the individual makes sure that his actions are balanced by virtue of halachic understanding and the Mesoras that goes with it, the tradition, that's how his father did it, that's how his grandfather did it, he really understands, he has a feel for how these things are meant to be weighed up. B'zois teichashvu chachomim unavoinim la'inei ha'amim. Says the Sipurna, now that you are the chosen people, it's important that you look good. It's important that you're impressive, that you look wise and understanding. And if you're going to try and play the balancing act and look wise and understanding, then it has to be only on the condition that there's a shmartim, that there's meticulous adherence to Mishnah, to everything that the Torah teaches before one practices it.